All right, everyone. This is Pop the Left with Derek Varn, or Hellfire and Varna Nation, and Douglas Lane. We're this week going to be talking about Christopher Lash, his book, The Agony of the Left and Populism. We're talking about this just a little bit before the U.S. presidential election, just a little bit before we may be seeing the demise of the latest version of U.S. populism, as it's, at least that's, maybe it's just a faux populism. But Derek has been working on writing a book about Christopher Lash, and I'm glad to get a chance to talk to him about it. This week I'm going to treat him more like a guest than a co-host, because he's been doing a lot of research. So Derek, welcome to Pop the Left, where you're no longer a co-host, you've been demoted to guest.
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, me and Shalom Valentine have been working on this book for about 3 months now. Who knows how long we'll be working on it. What propelled me to do it is I was, you know, seeing all this stuff about Trump and populism and Lash and the culture of narcissism and all his critiques here. And I saw that Lash was both hailed as a populist leftist because of his anti-elite stances, which were consistent throughout his career. But particularly when you read his early works, but pretty much throughout, he was highly critical of not just populism in general, but left populism in specific, for reasons that are very different than most of the critiques that liberals and like fairly elite leftists would make today. In fact, he would agree with them on the elitism of a lot of the liberal left and even a lot of the Marxist left. He would absolutely agree that it had taken an elitist turn and that this was negative. His critique of populism was something different, and he saw it as coming in cycles. In a book I didn't actually ask you to read part of, he talks about Harrington in the 1960s when he was trying to attach the remnants of the SPA, the Socialist Party of America, to the McGovern movement. Also deliberately engaging in left populism. And what I found fascinating in it is by the same arguments made by people like Tom Frank right now, almost the exact same arguments. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go into maybe a little bit of history of populism, left populism in America versus white populism, because populism can go either way. That's another thing about it. And maybe get people a little bit more familiar with the early economic situation coming out of the Long Depression in the United States, because it's actually super important to our history of left-wing struggle, but it's been eclipsed by people focusing on Europe and Asia for their history of leftism. And, you know, we're just as guilty as anyone else. We think, you know, I think understanding the European history of left is super important. Mm-hmm. But I do think we have to look at the developments here because they are related to developments in the economy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that will surprise people is this is actually related to this utopianism that we were talking about. And when we go into economic systems and possible answers to various socialist problems in our upcoming series, this is actually a bridge via gap. So what I want people to explore here is what left populism actually doesn't really do, and why it may not be enough. And it's not, you know, quote unquote class reductionism that's a problem. It's not, although racism was a problem in the left populist movements, and that's actually part of what killed it. But it's not class reductionism that's a problem. It's not even like, you know, a hostility towards elite opinion that's a problem, because, you know, frankly, maybe we need a little bit more of that sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's the immediatist viewpoint and strategy of populists. You know, something that like Lenin would call this trade union consciousness when he was arguing with, and you kind of facile nationalism when he was arguing with like the Mensheviks and the Narodniks in Russia, where these positions were a lot more nascent actually, because they weren't fully developed capitalist economy when Lenin was arguing this, but like these patterns come up over and over again. And what I want to like get out of the way is I've been reading parts of Tom Frank's book, but it's so new that I didn't really want to bring it into this discussion directly. But I think his critique of a lot of liberal elitism right now is totally valid. But I don't know what they're really, if what they're positing against it actually is as meaningful as they think, because it's kind of a heady stew of current conditions and wisdoms. And if you look at the emergence of the Knights of Labor and the Populist Party or the People's Party, and they both emerged in the 1890s, and the People's Party was a pretty serious force in the Midwest. The Knights of Labor was a fairly serious force in the 18th century going into the very early 20th. You can kind of see the limits. And Lash spends a lot of time in his book analyzing the left of the late 60s when he wrote The Agony of the American Left.
Yeah.
Focusing on this time period as when a lot of these trends start. And then he actually documents these similar trends showing up in populist movements and black nationalism, which he's writing before the Gary Conference, but after Harold Cruz's The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Yeah.
What kind of trends does Lash zero in on that came out of the populist movement?
Well, one, that it gets stuck in nationalist like equations, like that it still thinks in the forms of nation states largely. Two, that it has a very simplistic idea of class relations. And we've seen this in like the new economic left post, 2007, which it seems dead now in a lot of ways. In the 99% versus 1% arguments, that it has a very overly simplified version of class. And even when it gets slightly more complicated, like the current PMC argument, which, we can debate the merits of on another day. It still has a very like immediate and simple criterion for what it defines as class. Like, and Lash says this gets it into all kinds of problems, and it gives it a tendency towards conspiracy theories, towards being outflanked developmentally, towards appealing to immediate prejudice, actually, and not appealing to long-term interest. To me, the greatest example of that currently is something that Lash would have actually pointed out at the time of people missing the point of Marxist, writing about the Irish workers and how they were used to create a nationalist sentiment in Britain. But Marx isn't writing that to valorize the nationalist sentiment as a way for the workers to get what they want. He's saying that, like, this might work. This actually helps a capitalist in the long term. For a variety of reasons, even though cheap labor does actually objectively help capitalists in the immediate term. And Lash points out that all these problems actually end up with these movements continuously emerging, lasting for about two decades and dissolving. He traces that from the Populist Party and the Knights of Labor into the IWW and the SPA, and into the SPA's high point in the 19-teens, but really high point in 1918. And then it's, an inability to deal, after Debs's gelling and to deal with the emergence of the communist movement. And even though the SPUSA is much bigger than the SPA after the 1920s, none of them actually reached the size of either, actually, per capita of the population, the populist party, the Knights of Labor, and the SPA in its 1910s heyday.
Just to kind of interject a question or a perspective that might help me clarify what Lash is talking about. When I think about the populist movements of the late 19th, early 20th century, I think about the debates around silver and gold as the basis of money in the country.
Right.
And my understanding is that the reason that there was a desire from the populace to include silver and not just stay with the gold standard, which is, I think, what I'm if I'm remembering correctly, what their position was.
Yes, it was.
It was a matter of trying to create inflation in order to make their debts, to ease their debts as in the agriculture.
Yeah, it was inflationary debt devaluing.
Right.
Particularly in the agricultural sector. And this led to, actually very similar to now, they had coalitions with the Democrats.
Right. The Democrats were willing to take up that monetarist position and none of the others, according to Lash in the Agony of the Left, and or very few of the others. So they had more political aims as well around allowing for more democratic participation and changing the structures of government and a variety of other issues. But
the Populist Party endorsed a graduated and progressive income tax, a la the manifesto, actually, the direct election of senators, the formal establishment of an 8-hour work week.
Right.
And the establishment of a postal savings system a la Japan now. Mm-hmm.
And none of those are quite what a communist would think of as a maximalist position, but some of those might be the kinds of demands that would lead to more radical politics, and some of them are less so. And I think the silver and gold demand was one that was well entrenched in a capitalist ideology, because it would made sense in the short term for the agricultural sector, but it was an interest-based local kind of demand that was bound to not fully solve the full problem, because the North and the industrial sector was going to continue to be more productive and continue to take a larger share of the surplus, regardless of short-term solutions through manipulations of inflation, I think. But do you think that would be a good way to conceive of the limitations of the populist movement in terms of not having a complicated enough theory of what capitalism was?
Well, they also had an idea of popular culture. We might call it pro culture now, although they weren't. We need to talk about the base of these two movements, because they weren't exactly the same. The Populist Party was largely agrarian. It was popular in the South and the Midwest. In the Midwest, it was popular with tenant farmers. In the South, it was popular with former sharecroppers. One of the things that people, when they think about the American, a lot of communists, for example, will say, why did the workers' movement never take in America? And as a side note, it didn't really take anywhere, except in Russia, where it was probably the least developed. Mm-hmm. Why didn't it take off in America? And they'll talk about the yeoman farmer. But one of the things you need to always consider when you talk about the yeoman farmer is the two major forms of farming in the 18th century, even in settler areas, was tenant farming and sharecropping. So even the homesteaders would, the early homesteaders in the 1850s and 60s would rent parts of their fairly large plots out. Now, the difference between tenant farming and sharecropping is not insignificant. And sharecropping, you don't have choices over the crops you grow. So you're not even you are basically entitled to a plot where you grow the crop grown on all the plots. So it's kind of a monocrop sort of development, and you pay for your rent and kind generally as part of your harvest. But you also have monetary debts generally. Tenant farmers also don't own the land they own and pay a lot of their rents in kind, but also have monetary debts. They do have more say over what crops they grow. In both cases, you have something that is not quite agrarian labor the way we know it, and is also not quite... it's not peasantry or serfdom in the feudal or early modern sense. It's somewhere in between truly free labor. I mean, you do enter the situation freely, but you are under, you're under rentier compulsion in a way that you're not just with like, with proletarian, you know, pro-agriculture would be what you don't own any of it, and you're a wage earner. So it's a kind of a strange hybrid system that existed in America coming out, and the tenant farming came out of Britain. Sharecropping is, you know, is an almost unique leftover of the plantations system. One of the reasons why this kept on getting into, you know, and Lash talks about this. One of the reasons why this keeps on getting into kind of cul-de-sacs, though, is because maybe in some ways it wasn't class reductionist enough by our standards, and thus couldn't get past like some racial and ethnic cul-de-sacs that were emerging. Mm-hmm. It particularly because when they worked with William Jennings Bryan, who was, you know, not a particularly virulent racist by modern standards, although he was a religious fundamentalist. They were also, because they were working with the Democrats in league with former segregationists, and the Knights of Labor similarly wavered on, you know, their relationship to international labor. Famously, Powderly, one of the most important leaders of the Knights of Labor, kind of started equivocating on anti-Chinese massacres in the early 20th century and late 19th century. So it's a little bit, and that was because they were really stuck in the paradigm of the time they were operating in. And that's one of the things that Lash kind of criticizes populism as a whole for, is that its appeal to the population where they are is essentially what we in Marxist circles would call tailism. But it means that people are bringing all kinds of assumptions, even assumptions that are against their own immediate interest, into the fray.
Right. I mean, I think the left in general has a tendency to make those kinds of mistakes, and it's easy to condemn them, you know, from 100 years away. But the important thing is to learn from those mistakes and see if you can map them out yourself and I into the present moment and avoid making the same mistakes again, I suppose. I want to bring up a question from the comments here, even though it's off to the side, and see if I can frame it within our conversation. So they're asking, should Corbyn and the left labor split off to form their own party, maybe a socialist version of the SDP, the 81 Gang of Four? Seems like they have no other real choice. And my response is that they could probably try to do that. I don't know if they're, I suspect that there's not enough of a connection between the Labour Party, the left of the Labour Party, and the working class in the UK for that to be politically significant if they did that. That they don't, they might have some money from a certain sector of the urban left, but they probably not enough to really matter. Maybe I'm thinking like an American too much when I bring up the cash, but I would suspect that what we're really witnessing is just the death of the Corbyn moment here.
It would be my suspicion is that they don't have enough outreach into ex-urban areas and Northern Britain, which have been increasingly falling to the Tories, to build a popular base outside of their urban base within the Labour Party. And without that, they might become an influential power broker, maybe.
Yeah.
But I also suspect they won't have the cash. While UK election laws are not as cash intensive as ours, you can't do it without something. Right. Even though, you know, they have public funding for a lot of their election, and certain kinds of electioneering things are much more blocked off. But one thing I've been pointing out for the past 3 years is that increasingly, particularly towards the end of Blair, the voting patterns and the election style of the UK is increasingly like that of America, not the other way around. And while the parliamentary system means that it doesn't quite resemble it, I mean, there's no way, like, if we could have hung parliaments, we would have had like five. in the last decade. So we would also be in the kind of, we don't know when there's elections and there's going to be one all the time. But I mean, one of the things that Lash points out about this, and I am tying this together. I'm not just like trying to stay on what I scripted here.
Right.
Is that a lot of these populist movements actually don't retain popularity partly because as they lose momentum. I mean, like, as they lose momentum in relation to the labor cycle. Now, Lash doesn't state this way, so this is me interpolating. But if you look at the dates of when they rise and fall, they're pretty highly tied to market recovery. As slow as it was in the 1880s and 1890s, it did happen.
Yeah.
And as that happened, all they had was conspiracy theories because they didn't have a very elaborate theory of capital. You had immediate cash interest and that was it. Mm-hmm. Like, and so with Corbyn and whatnot, the state of the British economy since Brexit has been really hard to gauge. We're
pretty bad right now.
Yeah, it seems pretty bad. And it seems like Europe in general has had a tap and down election. I mean, not election cycle, although that too, a tap and down business cycle. Like there has been a business cycle but not nearly as extreme in the United States. I mean, that stands to reason they have a more regulated economy. But it also means that it's actually just been kind of like the slow growth shit that we had in America has been even more so there. And I don't know where that leads them, because their ascendancy seems to have been partly tied to the fact that labor had nothing to say to that low growth time priorly when they were in the Blairite, you know, neoliberal labor period. And now that Corbyn seems sort of discredited, I mean, I listen to British, you know, as much as I like to joke about how much I hate the British, I do listen to a lot of British radio for my international news because it's generally better. But like, contempt for Corbyn and officialdom is like universal there. And I don't know if they can overcome that. I find that interesting because, for example, in America, you don't have contempt for Bernie Sanders. He just seems irrelevant. But there does, like, and so I don't know if that means that Corbynism still has some life in it or not. Whatever it had in the Labour Party's over. Like, I think its inability to deal with Brexit and the economics around Brexit, like, and this is reflective of a kind of populist. There, one of the reasons I think it's interesting to bring up the gold standard, and this actually ties into like Corbyn and Sanders, is MMT actually reminds me of a lot of this trend in left thinking. And so, for example, like superficially speaking, the immediate description of the silver dollars or bimetallism, and even the greenback, because there's people who argued for fiat currency. At the end of the 19th century, they were superficially correct in what it would do, but they had no long-term outlook for what it would do. It was like, you know, they were like, well, if we deflate the value of currency, so we're inflating, you know, prices, this debt will deflate. Well, that's true. That'll happen. But what they're not looking at is how that'll spiral throughout the economy. And so this short-termism is kind of endemic of that. I actually similarly think like MMT's description of fiat currency, yes, of course the government can't run out of fiat currency. But if you totally primed it in the international markets and then do what MMT says it would do, which is tamp down on inflation by taxation, and it would have to be kind of regressive taxation because it has to slow down the flow of money in the regular economy. What you would see is a lot of decoupling sentiment of, you know, of middle class workers and working class from the program almost instantaneously. And so it's not extremely thought out. It's proposed. It's based on descriptions that are in some ways true, but the policy implications are very immediatist. Yeah.
You know, just the other day on Trigonometry, there's this kind of right-wing podcast out of the UK called Trigonometry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of these shows that is basing itself on the on a simplistic critique of the left all around how, you know, woke culture is pervasive and needs to be overcome. And we have to discuss difficult ideas. And, you know, on the face of it, I agree with all of that. But when you get down into the weeds, sometimes there are very significant disagreements between, I mean, almost always there are very significant disagreements. And they had this guy, James Rickards, on, and I think he is a good example of maybe the way that even the left populist assumptions can be taken up by the right, and how they are taken up by the right. James Rickards was talking about what needs to happen after COVID, and what he said was we need to inflate the dollar against gold. That will keep us our economy working. Otherwise, if we allow deflation to continue, our debts are going to be insurmountable.
Right.
And you know, in the short term, he may not be wrong.
But, I mean,
you know, but yeah. But he also is someone who's been working on advocating for the importance of precious metals. He's something of a gold bug, I think, for a long time. So, you know, he comes out of that milieu on the right. But yeah, anyway, I just thought I'd point that out. This stuff is still going on. This kind of thinking it's like MMT when it's on the left, and it's monetarism and an obsession with gold when it's on the right.
Well, I mean, theoretically, the obsession with gold would like its theoretical praxis is like the total opposite of MMT, right? Like, but its practical praxis ends up looking quite the same. Like when I was for something else I'm doing, I was actually going over a couple of MMT books and pamphlets and walking through them, and I found that like I was agreeing with about half. I was agreeing with what they were describing, particularly when they're arguing with like neoclassical economics from 20 years ago. But I was not agreeing with the reasons they attributed. And one of the things I like to point out about this is for example, there is no clear policy implication from an MMT standpoint about the European Union or about Greece. So if you think about the concept of currency sovereignty, you would think, okay, we need to break all these currencies off and so they can have currency sovereignty. But most MMTers actually do realize that countries are not autarkies, despite the fact that they were arguing, like some of the more fringy MMTers 10 years ago were arguing that they essentially were. And so some MMTers will say, no, you need more cooperation of the European Union, and it needs to have more of a, you need to get the political units closer to the economic units. And that if you tried to just decouple it in these small nations, they would of course fail on the international market. Now, that's, to me, that's interesting because that's like that's something you and I have been saying, like back when MMTers were saying the opposite, but now there are schools of MMT on different sides of this question, meaning that it doesn't actually answer the primary question. And what does this have to do with populism? Well, one of the things that Ingalls was actually, you know, writing about the United States in the 1870s and was saying like, the American like proto-left has a hard time having proletarian consciousness because one, there's so much land and it's available, and so there's an illusion of ownership. And two, Americans are obsessed with monetary schemes. Like he says this in like 1860s or in early 1870s. He's like, they're obsessed with monetary schemes. They keep on thinking that playing with the money will somehow fix the problem, whereas the problem is more in the realm of production. And that's because they don't really understand class and don't have a class consciousness. Now, that's the problem of the populist party, but that's not the problem of kind of labor populists like the Knights of Labor, right?
Someone's saying that gold is a money commodity, and we should remember that it is you know, central to Marx's theory of the labor theory of value, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, but that doesn't mean that Marxism is about making sure that the gold is
commodity correct. Money isn't the only form of money in Marxism.
Right. That's true. But also overcoming capital doesn't mean correctly relating like cash money to the gold.
Right. But the reason why I think that's important, actually, to validate some of the Colors impulse, is that Marx actually, in the footnotes of Capital Volume 1, in fact, we went over this together in one of our capital reading groups, points out that like sovereigns are always trying to claim, for sketchy reasons, that the power of money comes explicitly and only from the state, because that inflates the ability, the relationship with the sovereign. Now, in some ways, in modern imperial currency, that may be kind of true, in that one of the reasons why fiat money works in these capitalist cores, and I'm going to include China in this to piss people off, but it's also just objectively true, is that it has enough purchasing and production power, and China it's production, and the United States it's both production and purchasing, and enough, frankly, guns, and which is why like naval supremacy is a big deal for the Chinese right now, and it's been a big deal for every empire in the development of capitalism, to actually set their relation to the gold price artificially, through a mixture of, you know, are the petrodollar, if you want the modern commodity that is one of the many of the basket commodities that underlines modern money. As a side note, in the Grundrisse, Marx actually does point out that it doesn't have to be gold. And in Capital Volume 2, he talks about credit money. And we can go into if modern fiat currency is a form of credit money or not. I actually don't really know. Ultimately, though, the color is right. The commodity is what matters, and commodity money is still somewhere in the system. And I point that out also against the MMTers sometimes, that while Japan has massive debts and has a fiat currency, it has significant gold reserves. And one of the reasons why I think it has significant gold reserves is if it's hedging its bets that its relationship to the imperial core of the United States ever sours, it has something that's purchasable on the international market that has value beyond the reserve currencies that it may or may not hold.
Well, getting back to Lash, and I want to ask you a question here. Mm-hmm. That's maybe not, like, maybe we'll break you off your script, but why do you think it is that lately, let's say since Trump was elected, or maybe slightly before, Lash has become a figure that some people on the left are becoming enamored with again? I mean, you hear him brought up. Angela Nagel mentioned him frequently. The people at Afa Bunga Bunga talk about him.
I've been talking about him since 2014. Yeah,
we've both been talking about him. Is it because he's conceived of as being a populist? Is it because he seems to understand something about the working classes and their connection to conservative values?
I think what he actually sees, one of the things is he points out, and even in his late 80s writing, where people think it's his most conservative writing, he actually does point out that the quote unquote conservative values of the working class aren't really spoken to by conservative values. It's just that the more institutionalized left doesn't take the problems that those conservative values are speaking to very seriously. So one of the things he talks about is, for example, when you look at the inclusion of women into the household income of in the general market, what you saw was a rapid stagnation that was corresponded with a rapid stagnation in household income. And it was. All right. So you see a massive increase in women in the workforce between the late 60s and the 80s. And that is the time of what we would call neoliberalism. And we'll put that in quotation marks. And by the time that you had full influx of women into the workforce, the household income had essentially stagnated. like it hadn't changed from when, from a one income household to a two income household. It effectively stayed the same. And Lash pointed out that while there may have been progressive social benefits from this, denying that, that feminists not dealing with that was dishonest. And so a lot of people took that as a conservative argument. He also said, for example, that a lot of the conservative complaints about education disproportionately did speak to working class experience of schools, because schools for working class people have been stagnating for a long time. As an educator, this is, we all know it's true. Like, we know that very rural, poor schools and urban proletarian schools, like inner city, that's where the proletariat really is, right? Mm-hmm. Schools are shitty. We know this. Like, but we make excuses for it. All right. And some of our excuses sound weirdly racialistic, almost. Like, there's like this weird racial paternalism and stuff under it as a hide for the fact that, like, no, the experience that people have of this is pretty crappy. His other thing about marriage is he actually doesn't think we could go back to the quote unquote traditional bourgeois marriage, which people in the working class only really enjoyed, according to Lash, from like the late 1930s up until the 1960s. Like, there's only really one generation of working class people that had access to a stable nuclear bourgeois marriage. They had marriages, but they were in the context of multifamily, you know, larger extended family deals. And he also points out that prior to industrialization, now I disagree with him, these people were working class, or not, they're proto working class, but that women and men's labor was more, was actually, unless you were of the upper class, was a lot more equalized, because there was not a huge distinction between home and work life, particularly if, like, you're a tenant farmer, right? Like, mm-hmm. So that these problems are somewhat modern, and, like, you know, the Betty Friedan problem is a modern problem. And he kept on pointing out, like, single motherhood has not been great for working class mothers, which I think almost everybody now would agree with. But he was arguing with people in the 70s who actually did try to argue the opposite point. I don't think he thought that these class values were intrinsically conservative. I think he thought that he was worried about the current crop of intellectuals from the 1950s forward abandoning any relationship to the larger working class for technocratic and academic positions, thus becoming kind of a substrata class. You know, he doesn't call them a class like the PMC or anything, but like a kind of an all, like a strata that's really removed from the rest of society, and thus also has a fetish for, he would say, for lumpen, for more radical positions in minority groups that are actually commonly held, for weird intellectual groups, particularly students. He's like, the obsession with students is because they have a lot of leisure time and their class position is really unclear. Mm-hmm. And he attributes this to, like, how, like, okay, so populism doesn't work and was kind of racist, but what we're replacing it with is like ad hoc nothing. And it's also actually recapitulating a lot of the faults of populism. You're just assuming current conditions because you don't have a very complicated understanding of the way class structures work, or the way culture interplays with this and everything else, and the way, like, your individual psychology may be reacting to this. So
I just want to, I guess, Mike, when you, I mean, all of the things that you've mentioned so far are aspects of Christopher Lash's thought, which I do find it compelling and convincing. But one of the things that sort of undermines, I think, at least my love of Lash, one of the reasons I can't quite fully embrace him as a comrade to study deeply, that might help us in this moment, which maybe he is. I think, I do think that he's worth studying deeply, but I don't know I definitely think we're going to have to go beyond his thinking. Is this, he doesn't have a himself a theory of revolution that's motivating him.
Well, let's talk about that. You're right. And like he wrote an article that was republished in the book World of Nations called Is Revolution Obsolete? And he basically makes two arguments. So the insurrectionary notion of the revolution, as we understand it, can only happen in places where the capitalist state is very weak or not fully established. That after the atom bomb, that insurrectionary notion is kind of a non-starter. And that, right. that he thinks that Marxists have underestimated the power of the state because they came in with essentially 19th century assumptions against a 20th century state with capital accumulation and weaponry. Mm-hmm. He then goes on to say that he's very frustrated with all the other notions of revolution because they're essentially just metaphorical. But what he does not actually say is that revolution itself is obsolete. So he, kind of like us, is pawing at what he thinks would be a modern revolutionary idea, since the old insurrectionary model does not seem to be possible. And since all the new revolutions were like revolutions and cultural stuff that were easily appropriated by capital, which he was noting very early. So I think you're right, but it's not because he gave up on revolution. It's because he's struggling with what it would even mean now. What does it mean to have a violent confrontation with the state that doesn't lead to like mass worker annihilation, you know, against a state that has atom bombs? And like,
my question is, you know, and maybe this is a question we could aim at ourselves too, really, mm-hmm. is why, if you haven't given up on revolution as an aim, why focus as much as he did, and as we sometimes do, on critiquing those parts of the left which clearly have abandoned revolution? Why not work on a positive direction to re-theorize revolution?
I think your critique of him will be similar to your critique of the Frankfurt School. And that is because he actually, while he did think, he was largely influenced by the Frankfurt School, actually. I mean, he doesn't write like them, but that's,
he's an American and a journalist too, right? Or was he, or at least he was a popular writer.
He was a popular writer. He was actually a PhD in cultural history. He was a cultural historian, mm-hmm. but and his thesis was actually on the way liberals responded to the Russian Revolution, like mm-hmm. that was his first book. Mm-hmm. His concerns were now that workers' populism seems to be stalled out for whatever reason. Why isn't the left speaking to it? So instead of going full Frankfurt School with like the authoritarian personality answer and like, oh, you know, the authoritarian personality of capital has subsumed all of the workers' consciousness. He was more concerned with like, well, maybe the Frankfurt School is onto something, but it's not the authoritarian personality so much as the left just isn't speaking to any of this anymore.
Right. You know, I wanted to make a video for this Sunday about the culture of narcissism. And the title of it was going to be Are We All Narcissists or something like that. And that video probably will eventually come out. But what I realized was that I didn't know who the we actually was when I started rereading The Culture of Narcissism. It didn't seem to me to really be aimed at the kinds of people that he was describing in The Agony of the Left as the kinds of people who would have been involved in populist movements or even early 20th century socialist movements. No, it was aimed at an urban elite that had taken over the left project and professionalized it.
So one thing I'm going to give you a little hint on reading The Culture of Narcissism that I only got from one of Lash's students, actually, mm-hmm. who is my co-author's thesis advisor and our dissertation advisor. And what it is that you need to read his book, The Minimal Self, where he actually explains the psychoanalytic theories he's using, mm-hmm. And the Marxist theories he's using in more detail. He is talking about an urban elite, but he's talking about atomized workers as well.
Okay. All right. I wasn't sure about that. I thought maybe he wasn't really addressing the working class at all, because all the people he references are novelists and celebrity activists, and you know,
he's assuming what he's thinking is that it's filling up the mind space of the average worker through media. And because of their alienation and lack of community to get other ideas, the media plays an increased role. It's actually somewhat similar, a little bit more coherent than the Society of Spectacle idea, because the thick communities of the working class and of people in general have been deracinated by capital, that media actually stands in for an interstitial, and that media is run by these narcissistic elites that he is really railing against. Mm-hmm. And that is informing everybody's response to it. So that unless you're completely cut off, unless you're like a worker in a rural Idaho that doesn't have a TV, and you know, in like the 1970s, you are not totally immune to this either, because you exist in the social milieu whose image is portrayed upon you are dominated by this group of people. And so I get why people who like love the PMC thesis really like him, because he's talking to this, but what his answer to that is basically like, there isn't a good answer. And so my critique of Lash is similar to my critique of the Frankfurt School, is that he's like 90% right, but because of the negativism of his methodology, since he, you know, takes this assumption that you arrive at this stuff through critique, which has been a common Marxist assumption, right? Mm-hmm. He's not positing a concrete answer, just pointing out where these answers fall short or what the left isn't speaking to, I guess, in hoping that someone will speak to it who's more readily than him, because he's also critiquing, like he would admit, he is not part of the class that should be doing this.
Right.
From his perspective, he is part of the class he is critiquing. And he knows that, which I will also maybe say some of the other people who talk about this don't seem to acknowledge, but he is very aware of that. And one of the critiques I've heard made of him, I think is fair, is that he gets so into these debates on this elite left that he forgets what he's really like. But after the culture of narcissism, he's not really talking about the problems of like these mass movements anymore. He's more talking about, you know, this elite left that he's got an issue with, and he's mainly fighting with them.
Yeah, once you've been embraced by the president of the United States, your perspective is bound to change as to who you think the subject of history is, I think.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, and you've been saying it, but I'm just going to reiterate it, is that there's a section here in The Agony of the Left where he says many American Marxists have themselves embraced an economic determinism that owes more to the populist tradition than to Marxism, so that it is not surprising if Marxism is so often confused by Marxists and non-Marxists alike with the economic interpretation of history. And I connected that to something else he said, which is that the populists didn't have a Marxian notion of ideology. Mm-hmm. And I think that to understand what Lash is talking about is, I think there's a conflation of the allegation of economism that would have come up in the turn of the century between Bernstein and Rosa Luxemburg, because Bernstein was an economistic Marxist in so much as he thought that you could, through the state, regulate the capitalist economy into socialism. That was what economism was. It wasn't that you thought the economy was dominant or shaped a capitalist society and ultimately had, you know, and it wasn't that you were a class reductionist, but it was that you thought capitalism itself could be, without a revolutionary break, could be transformed into socialism, and that was what made you an economist or economistic. Either he's conflating those two positions together, or he's not, in which case the populists are economistic in the sense that Bernstein was.
I mean, they effectively are. Because right. If you think the issue is just how you handle the currency, that is a one-trick thing that you can do with the state to deal with monopolies. So in a way, it puts the left in a kind of impossible bind. And in Europe, we've talked about it. It put the left in this bind where they started like supporting bosses against even immediate labor needs so that they could develop into monopoly capital, take it over a la Hilferding and Bernstein, which unfortunately meant they got outflanked by the fascists later on in their Petit Bourgeois coalition. But in the United States, it actually seemed to mean something different where when this stuff got stalled out because of this immediatist assumption that if we just take the state and do this one or two things, we can get what we need. And no Marxist would mock you. I mean, when Marxists mock people for like wanting socialist health, socialized healthcare, whatever, is not Marxist enough and distracts from revolution. Like Marx himself would have slapped you for that shit.
Right.
But that isn't communism. It isn't even socialism. Like,
yeah.
Like, don't keep those things separate in your head.
Right. Right. So, but the point I was trying to get to with all of that talk about economism was that he seems to think that what Marx brings, or the Marxist socialist tradition in the United States brings to the struggle that the populace can't, is a critique of ideology rather than a commitment to a more complicated understanding of how the economy functions and the limits of a of the old economism of Bernstein.
I am conflicted as to whether or not I think Lash has a Gramscian notion of hegemony. He doesn't talk that way. He never mentions them. He does mention Foucault and he does mention the Frankfurt School. But mm-hmm. there are times in this, and particularly in the Agony of American Left, sometimes he sounds like that he is critiquing them for having an insufficient understanding of class. And the ideology is a blinder on understanding the larger structure of class, mm-hmm. in which case the two things are still the same. Like,
right.
And sometimes he sounds like it's a cultural hegemony issue, in which case your critique would be very valid. And I honestly, it's actually a problem of writing clearly, believe it or not. He doesn't specify exactly which he means. And maybe he doesn't even totally know. You know, as a cultural historian, his bias probably would have been towards culture. But he definitely, particularly if you read more of his writings from this period up until right before cultural narcissism, he's actually very good at stating out the material conditions and the historiography of each thing he's dealing with in a way that points out that he does get that, like, class formations are a much more basic than cultural problems. And the cultural problems are, you know, in a kind of feedback loop with the economy itself. Like he actually keeps on pointing that out in regards to feminist and black nationalists and cul-de-sacs that they get into. And it'd be very weird for him to see it there and not to see it with the populist movement in general. Yeah.
So I want to throw a few comments from people on the screen in order to demonstrate that the culture of narcissism thesis is not entirely incorrect. Someone says that I need an ironic side part. That's Susan Murray, who I congratulate as being one of the few women I've ever seen on a stream. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but someone else says that I need a middle part and to iron my hair straight, so we can see a weeaboo Marxist. So,
yes. So,
this is my way of transitioning out of the for the public live stream. We should, the next time we do this, continue on with Lash's Agony of the Left, if you'd like to. Because we'll do is we'll label it as something slightly different, so that it gets clicks. Because if we just keep doing the same title over and over again, the Agony of the Left, people don't click. So we'll make it seem more relevant. What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
Oh, I think that's great. I think the next section will interest people because it's highly relevant right now in our moment of BLM, because he picks up, he goes through the debates in the black nationalist and black socialist movements of the early 20th century, which I think are pretty crucial right now, because it's weird how much he's picking up of the black Marxist thinker Harold Cruz, who wrote The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Mm-hmm. And that book is weirdly prescient right now. And I have seen some people talking about it, but not a whole lot of people talking about it.
So in the parrot room, we're going to go to the parrot room in about like maybe about 10 after 8, 10, sure. 8 15 we'll start in the parrot room. And it'll be a live stream you can watch on the Patreon, and then we'll make it into an audio podcast later on, but for our patrons, and this will be an audio podcast as well. So all that's coming. But one thing that I want to say is, in the parrot room, we're going to give our election predictions, right?
Oh,
you ready for that?
Sure.
And we're going to come up with it quick. And we'll also, I want to talk about Glenn Greenwald, and because he just left the Intercept.
I literally just read that article like 5 minutes before coming in, and I didn't know you were going to bring it up.
All right. I just saw it too, just about right before we started the stream. So I figure we should be, you know, really topical and talk about Glenn Greenwald. There might be more gossip about other things in the
I'm going to talk about quantitative easing, believe it or not.
Oh, that's the exciting part. Will be
it actually kind of it is relevant,
right? I'm sure it's relevant, but you know, the parrot room is full of juicy gossip and
quantitative easing.
So everyone can look forward to that. So we're gonna leave it here. So thank you, Ralph, for the super chat, $5. We appreciate it. I should probably push for that a little bit more, but. More than that, I want people to go and join us in the parrot room if you want to see the second half. We'll start this at around
8:15. I'll pay for my lunch.
Yeah, right. All right. Thanks, everybody. This is pop. Yeah. This is pop.